is CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor. Here's John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor, and I welcome the senior fellows from the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, Bill Raggio and Tom Joslin, reporting for the Long War Journal, the Chronicle, the Diary, the Observation, the Analysis of the vast canvas of the Ummah and the jihadists who are disrupting life as we understand it, from West Africa to the Hindu Kush, from the Mediterranean to India, through the to the subcontinent. We begin, however, with a measure of a man from the United States. His name is Khalilzad, and his participation over many years, but particularly during the latter stages of the Trump administration and the early days of the Biden administration, in negotiating with the Taliban or representatives of parts of the Taliban in Doha, Qatar. Khalilzad is now commenting about the success and failure of his negotiations, in particular, who is to fault for the tragedy of the withdrawal, the exit from Afghanistan, leaving behind tens of thousands of human beings, men and women and children, who are prey to the Taliban because over the last 20 years, they cooperated or were said to work for or had a relative who worked for or said something positive about ISAF, about the United States, about democracy. Tom, I begin with you because you have posted in Dispatch your measure of Khalilzad's explanation. Who is Khalilzad and what is his explanation for the tragedy of August just past? Good evening to you.
Good evening, John. Well, Zalmay Khalilzad is a veteran diplomat who's worked on Iraq and Afghanistan. He's been in Washington circles for many years, certainly throughout the entire 9/11 period on and off. He's played a role diplomatically for the U.S. I think you'd be hard pressed to find any successes that he could tout during that time period. But, you know, he sort of is one of these Washington creatures that exists in that sort of being there mode. If you remember the movie Being There with Peter Sellers and sort of the satire of the Washington political establishment, you know, Zalmay Khalilzad's one of these guys who just being there has been enough to keep him in the game and keep him active in Washington circles. And when it comes to the negotiations with the Taliban, he was called upon in 2018 to lead the Trump administration's negotiations with the Taliban. Bill and I knew at that time, we said so publicly, and I wrote very forcefully at the time, that that was it. That spelled the death knell for the Afghan government, because Khalilzad really had no interest in anything that we would call peace, that he was basically there to just sort of negotiate an American withdrawal. And that's what he did. And he's trying to dress that up now and say that he accomplished that, the all the problems we've witnessed in Afghanistan, the quick collapse of the Afghan government, which is, you know, there are multiple causes of that, of course, not just him. But all these problems we've seen over in Afghanistan over the last year, that they really have nothing to do with him or his diplomacy. That it really was just the fault of the Afghan government. And, you know, look, nobody's going to rise to the defense of the now deposed Afghan Afghan President Ashraf Ghani. His term was a failure. There's no doubt about it. But it's also no doubt that Khalilzad's diplomacy with the Taliban paved the way for the Taliban's swift advances this year. Really, he was the chief enabler of the Taliban. He did nothing to negotiate on behalf of the Afghan government, which he basically helped depose them, really, when you look at his diplomacy in terms of freeing Taliban al-Qaeda prisoners who returned to the battlefield, cutting the Afghan government out of talks with the Taliban and delegitimizing it. Basically, you know, lying on behalf of the Taliban, which he continues to do. And so right now what's happening is he's going on TV and he's making these appearances, including on the Sunday morning shows, you know, trying to defend his track record. And as I say in the piece that I wrote, the reference, John, it's really just self-serving piffle.
Bill, I recall our many conversations about the negotiations in Doha. And the puzzle always presented was the Ghani government or any representative of the Kabul government were never invited. And that was a condition or maybe just a guideline that the Taliban insisted upon. It never made any sense. Did it? And I recall you calling attention to it all the time. These are two-party talks. The U.S. looking to get out the door and Taliban looking to get in the door. What is your measure now about how Khalilzad permitted that to go forward and didn't call the talks off unless and until the Ghani government was at the table?
Yeah, this should have been a non-starter from the beginning. You know, Tom and I warned about this time and time again. Excluding the Ghani government, the Afghan government from direct negotiations would lead to failure. And we've been proven right on this. I mean, I don't think you needed to be a genius to figure this out. The Taliban believed that the Ghani government, that the Afghan government was merely a puppet of the U.S., of the West. And so the Taliban refused to renegotiate with that puppet and said, no, we'll go right to the top. The irony in all of this is that by the U.S. excluding the Afghan government, they proved the Taliban to be correct. And so the Taliban, once they get that, this is why their entire strategy was based on getting the U.S. to leave. If it wanted to restore the Islamic Emirate, it would get the U.S. to leave the country. To do that, it would negotiate directly with the U.S. And then it would never, in good faith, negotiate with the Afghan government. So, you know, you didn't need to be, again, you didn't need to be, have a master's or a doctorate in foreign policy and in political theory to understand what the Taliban were doing. Khalilzade and the rest of the U.S. foreign policy establishment were so smart. They were so smart that only they could not understand what the Taliban was doing and what the Taliban achieved here. So, you know, Khalilzade's attempts to turn this back on the Afghan government, he already neutered them by refusing to let them participate in negotiations. And then he's going to sit and turn and say the Afghan government didn't negotiate with the Taliban. The Taliban never wanted a ceasefire. It didn't agree to a ceasefire after the U.S. withdrawal. It went for the win because it knew that the Afghan government was weak and on the ropes.
Tom, it's called magical thinking. That's a popular metaphor. Did Khalilzad lead the magical thinking that the Taliban was going to in some way be domesticated? Or was he following the lead of the Trump administration and then the Biden administration? Can we tell?
You know, John, this is the way I put it. There's a documentary called Made You Look, which is about one of the great art scandals in New York City over the last decade or so, last two decades. It's a great documentary I would recommend everyone to watch. And one of the chief figures in that documentary, at one point, this reporter is talking about her and says either she was complicit in this and totally involved, or she was too stupid, basically, for her position. And that's basically an incompetent. That's basically what you end up with Khalilzad. He's either complicit in it and knows exactly what he's doing, or he's too stupid for his role, his job and all this. Either explanation is a bad one. But let's make it very easy here. What Bill said is exactly right, and something we've said over and over again. The Taliban very loudly claimed and said over and over and over again that they were fighting to resurrect the Islamic Emirate in Afghanistan. Well, why is that important? Well, Khalilzad now, even now, is going on TV and pretending that there was a political settlement to be had between the Afghan government and the Taliban. And he blames Ghani and the now deposed Afghan government for failing to reach his political settlement. Well, that's a non-starter. Why? Because the Taliban said from the beginning it wasn't going to reach a political settlement with Kabul. So why is it that Khalilzad is still repeating this lie or this dishonest talking point at this late date? Either he's still lying on behalf of the Taliban and pretending the Taliban was reasonable actor here, or I'm sorry, an actor that was actually interested in peace, which of course they weren't, or he doesn't know this. Well, here's the thing. I pointed out in my piece, the agreement that he signed with the Taliban is still up at the State Department's website. You can download it. You can see it in one of the links to my piece. And in that agreement, the Taliban over and over again refers to itself as the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan, which, as Bill and I have explained many, many times, is their totalitarian regime, which was overthrown in 2001. And the State Department very clumsily says in that agreement they don't recognize it, but the Taliban insisted on calling itself that throughout the entire time of talking with the U.S. And in other words, they weren't hiding this, John. They weren't pretending that they really wanted a political process with Kabul. They were saying what they were all about all along. And you really had to be either complicit in that with the Taliban and their goals, or really too incompetent for your role.
Bill, my memory also is that in the back and forth in Doha, there was often talk of releasing prisoners held at Bagram Air Base, as I remember. And the idea was the prisoners would be released, but there was no quo for the quid. Do I remember correctly? And were those prisoners released? Were they part of the Taliban offensive, or were they the ones that were let out of jail by the Taliban offensive? I can't recall.
Yes, so you're absolutely correct. So again, that negotiation was directly between the U.S. and the Taliban. But the then Afghan government was the one holding the prisoners at Bagram. They had all been transferred to Afghan control. So the U.S. forced the Afghan government, pressured and Khalsa played a major role in shaming the Ghani regime and pressuring them to release those Taliban prisoners. And yes, you're absolutely correct. A large number of them, including Taliban commanders, were once they were released, they returned back to the fold. I remember at one point I saw the number being around 30 to 40% of the 5,000. So you're talking a significant, you're talking thousands of fighters going back into the Taliban ranks, and that was only the knowns. These are the ones they could tell that went back. I would guess that number was probably approaching 100%. Those Taliban fighters were, unless they were injured or you know really broken, they were eager to get back into the fight.
And Tom, just the final remark before we turn to Afghanistan today and the stories about ISIS. Final remark, is Washington's measure that the tragedy we saw in August was avoidable if these negotiations had gone in a more logical fashion, or was it always going to come to this no matter what Khalilzad did or did not say?
You know, I don't think there was any logic. There's any logical or coherent argument that Washington can offer for any of this other than this process directly enabled and led to the Taliban's swift takeover of the country this year and that they should have seen it coming. What I would say about the chaotic withdrawal this year is it disproves actually a big part of the State Department and Khalilzad's talking points to the public. The one thing that he'll point to is say, well, the U.S. Beginning in February of 2020 through the middle of this year, basically they needed Khalilzad to deal with the Taliban in order to prevent the Taliban from attacking the U.S. And because they didn't attack the U.S., the deal was a success. But actually, that's disproven if you look at what happened this year. The U.S. actually missed the withdrawal date given in Khalilzad's deal with the Taliban of May 1st. The Biden administration got the Taliban, for the most part, to hold off on attacking and launching offensives against the Americans for several months because the Taliban knew that the U.S. was still leaving. And that's what the Biden administration said. In other words, the Taliban was always willing to allow, for the most part, the U.S. to just leave without attacking. They were going to secure the retreat of the American NATO forces. It's not some major diplomatic achievement to say, well, you know, hey, I got them to watch us retreat. No, they were always willing to watch us retreat. And there's still questions, obviously, about the attack at the airport that happened in August. And there are other sort of minor examples. But for the most part, the Taliban was just willing to watch the U.S. and NATO retreat. And Khalilzad doesn't have much of a talking point or any talking point really there that makes any sense either.
I am speaking with Tom Joslin and Bill Rojo of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracy's Long War Journal. They are senior fellows discussing what was Khalilzad, the Trump and Biden administration negotiation with bad actors. We turn to now what is ISIS in Afghanistan, and is it a credible threat? Is it dragging a Taliban into a contest that it is not equipped to fight? This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Tom Joslin and Bill Rojo of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracy. They keep the Long War Journal. And I come now to the Afghanistan that is. It's non-transparent. We have no good reporting sources, so we do what we can from the inside and the outside. This is the New York Times summarizing ISIS. The ISIS attacks have been aimed mostly at Taliban units and at Afghanistan Shiite minorities. Suicide bombings in Kabul and in important cities such as Kunduz and Jalalabad and Kandahar have killed at least 90 people and wounded hundreds of others in the span of just several weeks. Most recently, a coordinated attack by Islamic fighters against a hospital, a military hospital, killing at least 25 people, including a complex attack, a suicide bomber, and then shooters. So, Bill, I start with you. The ISIS presentation in Afghanistan is dragging the Taliban into a contest that it claims it can win if and how. Now that it's going on for several weeks, what is your measure of ISIS's plan? Because it has not been answered by the Taliban, and their regime in Kabul does not seem any better equipped than any other capital to deal with guerrilla fighters.
Yeah, John, I think the ISIS threat in Afghanistan in general is overblown. It's a operating as a terrorist organization. It doesn't control territory. It's not able to meet the Taliban on the battlefield, control territory. It doesn't have foreign support. It doesn't have local or regional allies. It's an isolated group that is highly committed. Estimates are in the thousands. Who knows how many fighters it has? It's a thorn in the side of the Taliban, but I don't think it threatens the Taliban's rule. It's basically what it's done since the U.S. has withdrawn, is conducted about one high-profile attack once every either week or every other week, depending on how you score it. Most of those 90 casualties are against soft civilian targets against Shia. One of those attacks, that suicide assault in Kabul, targeted a military hospital. So, you know, is it threatening? Is it a direct threat to the Taliban? Is it going to overthrow the Taliban? In the short to midterm, I say that's highly, highly unlikely. How things play out in the long term, it remains to be seen. But the Taliban is firmly in control of the country of Afghanistan. It controls all the levers of the state. It defeated a U.S.-backed military and essentially defeated the United States. I don't think an isolated group like the Islamic State poses a major threat to the Taliban at this point in time. A lot of this reporting, in my opinion, is breathless and overwrought. It's overestimating the capabilities of the Islamic State and really doesn't account for the fact that the Taliban is in firm control of the country.
Tom, significant voices at the Pentagon and led by Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Mr. Milley, have talked about Al-Qaeda reconstituting itself in Afghanistan. You and Bill have argued eloquently for many years that Al-Qaeda never left. It doesn't have to reconstitute, just has to turn around and have another cup of tea with its colleagues. However, does Al-Qaeda have an answer to this problem that the Taliban is struggling with now, or is it an indifference to Al-Qaeda given its larger mission? We have a couple of minutes, Tom.
No, Al-Qaeda is heavily invested in the Taliban's fight against ISIS, just as it was heavily invested in the Taliban's fight against the U.S.-backed government. You know, some of the first leaders of ISIS in the region were Al-Qaeda defectors who, for one reason or another, were disapproved or unhappy with the chain of command at the time and decided to seek a different outlet for themselves. But the Al-Qaeda knows ISIS well. It knows the commanders well. They've been at loggerheads, for example, in eastern Afghanistan, where Al-Qaeda dealt them some very big blows. Ironically enough, while the U.S. was providing de facto air cover for the Taliban and Al-Qaeda forces in eastern Afghanistan. So, you know, Al-Qaeda is definitely involved in this. I mean, I think to Bill's point, you know, ISIS became the shiny object in counterterrorism circles some years ago. What happened was about 10 plus years ago, the Obama administration, U.S. government assumed that Al-Qaeda was all but dead. And then ISIS comes along and it becomes this big new shiny object for everybody. And they can't explain that away. But they basically kept that assessment of Al-Qaeda that it was close to dead all along, even as Al-Qaeda was helping to defeat the ISIS in different places in Afghanistan, for example, and turn it back. So this is an ongoing story. ISIS remains in the fight and will continue to be a thorn in the side of them, I would say.
Tom Joslin, Bill Raggio, they are senior fellows, the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. They and their colleagues keep the Long War Journal. This is a chronicle, a diary, and an analysis of the vast canvas. We've concentrated in Afghanistan because of the imminent tragedy where America now is reviewing what went wrong and what is to be done. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.